time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 27th of July 2013. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirawa. On Saturday, the 27th of July, Christina Patterson talked to Christine about alcoholism and Emily Parsons from the Village Project.
We're talking to Christine this morning about her journey with alcoholism, or her experiences with alcoholism. Christine, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Christina.
And I just wanted to, obviously I invited you today because I'm interested. I've just been reading, I don't know if you heard on the way over in the car with the radio on, but I was just talking about some of the issues around alcohol. In our society around New Zealand, we have a bit of a drinking culture, I would say, and you know, just in the papers just this past week, police have said that all incidences that they've been called out to were alcohol related. So I thought it'd be great to talk to you and hear a little bit about your story.
Oh, right. Okay.
Where would you like to start? Where does it all start?
Well, it all starts really with, I mean, alcoholism is something that can affect anybody over any creed of race, religion, age, gender. So anyone who picks up a drink runs the risk of being at some stage an alcoholic. Now, it's a disease. Essentially, it's a disease. And it's a disease of a mental obsession combined with a physical allergy. And it's progressive. So when I started drinking, I was like any other teenager, out for a good time, you know, drinking too much, but never in my wildest dreams imagining that one day I would cross that line into alcoholism. And that's where I mean it's progressive. So today's drinkers, the young people who are getting out and completely trashing themselves, are really running a huge risk that they will at some stage cross that invisible line where it's gone from having a good time and overindulging into being something that they can no longer do without.
Are there common elements to a person who might become an alcoholic and someone who doesn't?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's almost a personality disorder as much as anything. For myself, I mean, growing up, I always felt like a square peg in a round hole. We are, as a collective group of alcoholics, we are super sensitive, which means really, if we're honest about it, means we're self-absorbed. We have a lot of self-interest. We don't take criticism well. You can't tell us much. We have huge egos, but we have low self-esteem. Now try and work that one out, you know. We're 10 foot tall and bulletproof in one breath, and not feeling good enough or fitting in anywhere else in another sentence. And so we're not aware of those things at the time. So when we start drinking, alcohol is a good way to deal with feelings that we don't want. I used to drink because I couldn't deal with feelings.
Is that something that do you think comes from someone's experience in their family?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, it would be easy for me to sit here and say, oh, I became an alcoholic because my mother died when I was very young and I came from a dysfunctional family, or I had a bad school teacher, or my husband left me, or any of those things. It's got nothing to do with it. Alcoholism covers a broad spectrum of people. There are people who come from extraordinarily good families, well-bred, well-educated, wealthy, to the lower socioeconomical group of people, right through the spectrum. There's no rhyme or reason to it. I believe, and I couldn't be 100% sure, but I do believe that it's genetic and that it can skip generations. So whereas your parents may not have had a drinking problem, somewhere back in your family history, there might be a problem with alcohol or gambling or overeating. any of those addictions, sort of, and they are, I mean, alcohol. I'm here to talk about alcohol, but the thing is, they are an obsession and an addiction, and if it's not one, it can be another.
It seems to me that from what – now, you know, I have a little bit of information, so it's great that you're here to correct some of the – you know, I might not have the right information. From what I understand, in a way, alcoholism or drinking alcohol perhaps in a way that's not what's the word?
Just socially acceptable?
It sounds like that can be almost medicating, used as a medication.
It is going on inside
a person, yeah?
Well, yes, there is that. A lot of people will drink because they can't deal with their feelings. They constantly feel wounded, even though there's no apparent reason why they're feeling wounded. But the biggest, thing that we have in common as alcoholics is denial. Mm-hmm. I mean, essentially, we live in denial, and so we will drink, but no matter what happens to us when we drink, we never recognise the drink as being the problem. It's always something else. It'll be an outside fact. Oh, well, if only they would do this and I wouldn't have to do that. And, if it, you know, there's a blame game. A huge blame game goes on. And the denial factor of this disease, and it is a disease, is just extraordinary. Because, you know, if you think about it, if you see a man in the street or a woman in the street, and they're all, or a woman in here, just say you see a woman somewhere, a young girl passed out drunk with a skirt hiked up around her and falling out at the top of her clothes, you've got to ask yourself, did she start out the evening? Did she actually start out the evening saying, I think I'm going to go out and drink until I'm lying in somebody's back seat of their car who I have no idea who they are, I'm unconscious, my skirt's up around me? And the answer's no. They started out the evening to have a good time and some drinks, maybe get a bit drunk, but certainly not end up in a state of unconsciousness, possibly vomiting, with half their clothes missing. The thing is, in the morning that they're likely to come to and be terribly remorseful for a day, but then the denial kicks in, and the belief that next time that won't happen. Next time I'll be able to drink just like anyone else.
Right.
Next time I'll just have a couple and I'll be fine. And the absolute pitiful thing about alcoholism is that we all believe that, and what has actually happened to us is that we can't just have one or two drinks.
Mm.
We, you know, other people say all the time, well, why don't you just stop?
Mm, yeah.
And that's when I'm talking about the allergy, the physical allergy has kicked in with the mental obsession.
Right.
The obsession being, I can just have a couple of drinks. And the physical allergy, it's like a light switch goes on after the first couple of drinks, where it's like a man in the desert seeing water in front of him going, I've got to have that.
Yeah. So, and I'd like to come back to the denial, because I think it's really quite an interesting thing, and talk about responsibility as well.
Yes.
But is it, I mean, it's probably quite a hard thing to define, because it seems to me that there are lots of different types of drinkers as well. You know, different types of people who have, you know, you have one person who might go out on a binge.
Yeah.
And you have another person who might drink every day.
Yes.
So it very different types. Can you talk to us about that? And it's probably quite hard to define the line as to when you're stepping over, but can you help us to understand where that line might be?
Yes. No, I started out drinking, as I say, like anyone else. I drank at parties. I drank socially. Admittedly, I always drank a bit too much and got, you know, can I say the word pissed?
Yeah, go on.
You know, but, you know, no harm done. I was good. Everyone liked me. Good times were had by all. No damage done. Over a period of years, that drinking started to increase. And I started to undergo a change in my personality. I was no longer, there would come a point in my drinking, the first few hours of the party might be fun or whatever, wherever I might be, and then something would change within me and I would become what I call an ugly drunk. You know, the abusive person, the person that makes trouble, the person who's mouthy, all of those things, that was me. Until socially, I was not really wanted anywhere. And this is over a long period of time. We are talking years here. Eventually, I stopped going out and started drinking at home. I never used to drink at home on my own, but then I started to drink at home. Because I needed, you know, I came home from work at night and thought I need to have a drink. Now, this went on for years, and I was what I call a functional alcoholic, in as much as I always managed to go to work most times. I worked throughout my alcoholism. I built a house throughout my alcoholism. But I woke up every morning with my head down the toilet and not remembering at what stage I'd gone to bed. And by the end of the day, I was taking an inventory of the fridge just to, you know, what have I got to drink? And coming home from work and saying to myself every single night for years, I'm just going to have a couple of drinks while I make the dinner, just like normal people do. Never happened.
So the at some point, the obsession started.
Well, it's the obsession with thinking about having a drink. At lunchtime, I've still got a hangover, but I'm thinking about what I'm going to have to drink when I get home. And the allergy is the physical body saying, I'll just have a couple. But once that couple stepped in, it's kind of like, I've got to have more. You know, it's a more thing. It's just very hard to explain.
Mm.
Talking about binge drinkers and daily drinkers, most people think alcoholics are people who are drunk all the time.
Right.
They're sitting in parks with brown paper bags and raincoats on, or they're wandering around the street at midday and they're drunk. Not true. Most alcoholics that I know actually were binge drinkers, and that means that they would go for days, a week, a month maybe, without having a drink. But when they did drink, they couldn't stop. And no different to me. They picked up that first drink and they couldn't stop. So that binge, that decision to have a drink caused by an absolute mental obsession with, justifications in the head. That's what I mean by the obsession, is it just won't quit.
Mm.
That drink that they are having that they haven't had for a week, it can turn into 2 days. It can turn into 3 weeks where you just don't see them. They're home and they're drinking, and there's bottles everywhere, and they're lying in their own filth, but they still keep doing it. And that's, you know, the awfulness of the disease. And then they pull themselves out of it and go for another length of time and go back to work and apologise to the boss or whatever. You know, and that's the binge drinker, but they're no less alcoholics than I am.
Right. So it sounds to me like it's a gradual thing.
It is.
It starts with an obsession and not being able to stop once you start drinking, whether that's how often you drink.
Yes. And not only that, of course,
not necessarily the issue, it's more that you can't stop.
Well, what happens too is that you build up. You know, I mean, the first time I had a drink, I remember it distinctly. I drank a bottle of beer and I was off my face, you know. But over a period of years, I learnt to drink an awful lot of alcohol and still maintain. You know,
yes.
I did terrible
high
things.
High tolerance.
I built a tolerance for it that was frightening. You know, the medics would say you should be dead, and they're right, I should be. And I did terrible things. I drove and I, you know.
It probably didn't start out like that, though, did it?
No, it didn't start out like that.
And it slowly, gradually went that way.
That's what I talk about, the invisible line we cross, and it is invisible. It's going from being possibly a heavy drinker and a person who drinks too much occasionally to someone who's drinking too much all the time, every night. In my case, it was going home from work, standing in my kitchen saying, I'm just going to have a couple of G&Ts while I get the dinner on. And the next minute I know I'm waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning with all the lights on, the dinner on the stove, and I've passed out. Now, that was never, to say, oh, well, you know, why can't you just stop? if I could just stop, I would.
Yeah.
It's like people saying to me today, why don't you just have one drink? Mm. You know, just have one. And I say, I can't have one. There is no, the only reprieve for an alcoholic is to stop drinking altogether. Right. We just cannot handle it anymore. And the scary part about it is, I haven't had a drink for 18 years. But if I was to go out tomorrow and have a couple of drinks, within 3 or 4 days, and I've seen this happen, I've seen it happen to people who have been sober for 20 years, within 3 or 4 days, I would be right back to that point where I was when I eventually reached out and got some help.
Right. So tell me a little bit about how alcohol can, when it's got to this point, starts to affect your life and the people around you.
Well, I mean, as far as all right, I reached a point in my drinking where I no longer connected with anyone. I stayed in my house. I didn't want to answer the phone. I didn't want to see anyone. So it's isolating. You just, there's a cocoon around you, and you no longer can relate to people on any level, you know, because you've just killed any sort of social skills or normal emotional feelings. You've just deadened with alcohol. So you're in a world that you can't connect with people anymore. Or the only, I knew two emotions when I got recovery. One was fear and loneliness. And it is the loneliest disease in the world. And that's really, you know, how it affects your family. Well, of course it affects your family, because they're tearing their hair out saying, why can't you just stop? And I mean, it doesn't take you anywhere good. You will end up in police cells. You will. I worry for the young girls today, because I look at the states they get themselves into.
The vulnerability.
And the vulnerability. Yeah. And we're not living back in the 50s, where some gentleman comes along and picks you up and straightens you up and says, I'll take you home, and drives you home. That is gone with the wind. So I do worry, plus the fact that they are physically killing themselves, because you see, once you start to drink the way I drink and the way alcoholics drink, and you start to just, it becomes your diet, shall we say, there's only one road you're heading to, and that is insanity or death, and it's a very slow death.
Yeah, and you're kind of taking a lot of people with you in a way, aren't you?
Well, you
in
are.
That really negative journey, because it does hurt the people around you.
I get calls from people all the time saying, would you please help my son? Would you please help my daughter? Would you please help my mother?
Mm.
And the sad part about it is, I have to say to them, look, I can't help them unless they want help. You've got my number. If you can get them to ring me, I will help them. But I can't just barge into their life. You know, there's a saying, you can tell an alcoholic anything, but you can't tell them much. You know, you can always tell an alcoholic, but you can't tell them much. And until people reach that almost rock bottom level, where they know, where the alcohol ceases to work for them anymore, and that's where it goes. All right. The things that, all the good times have gone, all the happiness has gone, all the.
It's got to get pretty bad often, doesn't it?
It gets pretty bad. Yes.
And so they're on this journey, really, and it sounds to me like there are two things keeping them going down that road, and it sounds like it's denial and shame.
It is. It's definitely
because
denial.
They're in that. Why I'm saying shame is that. I'm wondering, actually I'm asking you, because I don't know, but perhaps that shame of what has happened. I mean, yes, there's the denial part, I imagine, where you're justifying why you did that, or it was so-and-so's fault, or that, you know, it's because of my childhood, or it's because of my alcoholic father, or it's, you know, that's all the denial part, isn't it? Or I was really upset and I just needed a good night out, or whatever the excuse is.
Self-justification. Yeah.
And
the denial is when you start saying to yourself, is when you don't look at the fact that alcohol, that you can't drink like normal people. You see, you know, I started every night, I'd say, all I ever wanted was to drink like normal people.
Right.
I just wanted to be able to have a couple of glasses of whatever, put the cork in the bottle and say that's it. So every time I had a drink, I was aiming at that. Mm. But, you know, the definition of insanity is repeating the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Right.
And I never got that result.
But I imagine also, you know, with the shame side of it, whether people do feel ashamed of their... They get to the point where they do feel ashamed of their life but feel so helpless
that
the only result, the only medication they have for that, I guess that feeling, is perhaps to drink. That gets you into a vicious cycle.
No, I'd have to say sadly no, because the shame actually comes in recovery.
Okay.
When the fog has cleared and the damage is
okay.
Because it's recovery is about being honest.
Wow.
Recovery is about having a good look at yourself and taking ownership.
Okay.
So what happens when you're drinking is you have your moments of remorse, usually when you work, because we're selfish people. Terribly, it's a selfish disease. That's what I mean about self-obsessed. We're terribly selfish people. And so when you wake up in the morning and you're in a blackout, you've had a blackout, you can't remember getting home, and you go out to have a look at the car to see that it's parked where you think it is and there's no blood on it, you have moments of shame and remorse. Or when your friends ring you up and tell you what an absolute idiot you made of yourself and how you upset so and so and so and so, you cringe in bed and you have huge remorse for a while until the hangover clears a little bit, and then you start thinking about having the next drink.
Okay.
So it's that sort of cycle. The shame actually comes with sobriety. That's when it all stops and the fog is cleared but that's okay. You have to learn to feel things, and you have to learn to get to be emotionally mature and essentially grow up.
Right. What we're going to do, we're going to give people a little break, and we're going to come back and talk about recovery and where people can go for help, and why recovering actually is a good idea. Sounds like it's hard work. Sounds like it takes an enormous amount of courage. We're here with Christine this morning on Island Life, and we're just talking about her story on alcoholism, and she's just giving us some insights, some amazing insights, actually. We've been talking about what alcoholism is, what it looks like, how it affects lives, but we're also wanting to talk about what, you know, it's often at the point at which... it's not really working for them anymore. Would that be right, Christine? And that life has become, you know, it is really getting pretty bad. And it's, I suppose, sometimes for some people, pretty bad is can be really, really bad, can't it, before they'll do anything about it. But tell us why someone should get help or have that courage to at least talk to somebody about their issue, and also what kind of help, you know, is there help out there for them, and what kind of help do they need?
Well, it's not really for me to tell people when they should or should not get help. I think that anybody who's drinking has got out of control, deep in their heart, knows that it's got out of control, but there's that vain little bit of stubbornness and hope that one day they'll be able to drink like other alcoholics, other normal people.
Yeah.
For me, what happened was that the drink actually turned on me in the end. All the good things about it brought back all the insecurities and character defects, shall we say, that I possess, and I became increasingly isolated and terribly, terribly lonely. But I hit a rock bottom. I used to always say to people, oh, well, at least I haven't done this, and at least I haven't done that. And then what I forgot to add to that is the word yet. And I did one of those yets, and we talked a little before about girls ending up in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people. That pretty much happened to me. and when I say it happened to me, I brought it completely upon myself, and certainly not blaming anyone other than myself for that. But it was the one thing that I never thought I would do, and when I did, it was a real. It crushed me. It completely crushed my soul, and I knew then that if I could do this once, I would do it again, and that the drink had taken me to this dark place. And I just knew that I realized I'd crossed a line. So there is help out there. There are some wonderful 12-step programs. I'm a contact for the island for a 12-step program, and essentially, what happens is that once the alcohol clears your system, you then have to do a bit of work on yourself that involves self-honesty, and it's stopping blaming other people, looking at things in your life, getting to know who you are, because in effect I didn't know who I was. I was anything that anybody wanted me to be. I was a master actress, but I had no idea who Christine was. And so over 18 years, I've learnt who I am, warts and all, and I've had to make a lot of changes in my life. And I can only say that my worst days in sobriety are better than any of my best days drinking. So there is life beyond alcohol and drugs. I'm totally sober. I don't do drugs either. Nothing mind-altering, because that's not for me. And I have to say that I've got, in the last 18 years, I've got a life, whereas I don't think before I really had one.
So it sounds to me like, so two questions really. One is, what is this 12-step program given you? And what is, I guess, recovery brought you in your life?
The 12-step program has given me a good look at who I really am, and if that sounds like that people, if somebody's sitting there saying, "Oh, I don't really want to know who I am," it's in a loving way.
The self-esteem's come back.
We are all brought into this world with love. And we're all designed to love ourselves. And I don't mean that in a egotistical way, but we are all designed to be loving to ourselves, and to recognise that we are enough, and that we are good enough, and that we are enough, and we're as good as anybody else. And so it's taught me that, and that I had no idea that I actually had such low self-esteem, because I had such a massive ego. I was arrogant, incredibly arrogant, and I knew how to fight my way out of things. I had to grow up. I've learnt that I'm selfish, and I've learnt that to stay sober and to live a good life, I have to think less about me and a bit more about other people. Which for an alcoholic is a big ask, because, as I say, I make no bones about it, we are self-centred people. And so there's certain things I have to do, and it's a spiritual program. I'll make no bones about that. I have a spirituality in my life now that was lacking before, and I think it's been the biggest gift to me in my sobriety, which doesn't mean to say I go around ramming religion down people's throats. It's got nothing to do with religion. It's about spirituality.
I think about that serenity prayer.
Yes.
Now, would you say that serenity is more in your life?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. I remember going back to as a small child, always feeling anxious, always having a slightly sick feeling in my stomach, never knowing why, you know. And I didn't know what... two things, hope and serenity. I didn't know what either of those things were until I got sober. And hope is huge. It's knowing that, you know, that life can be beautiful out there, and that it alcohol doesn't have to play any part in it. And absolute serenity of knowing, I remember what I did yesterday, I don't have to hide from anyone in the street. No one on this island, fortunately, has ever seen me drunk, but there'll be people in Auckland who, to this day, even though I'm sober, would remember what I used to be like and perhaps be a little suspicious and think, oh yeah, but I remember when, you know, nobody changes. And that's not true. People do change if they're prepared to change their attitudes.
So now I imagine that you get by doing a program like a 12-step program excuse me, that you have a sense of community together, of other people understanding, and you know, and that must be a relief. But at the same time, I wonder whether people, you know, whether you've ever heard the comment, I suppose, of feeling depressed going to such a place because they're having to face their own weakness and other people's weaknesses. And do you understand what I'm asking?
Really.
Okay. I'm wondering for those people who feel that they can, and perhaps they even have, remained sober without a program, whether, the, you know, who may actually say, you know, going to a program actually would make me want to drink. You know,
no.
How do you feel? Have you had those comments?
No, I've had the absolute honest, I've had the absolute opposite. I've seen people come into a program, get sober for a little while, go back out and give it another try, and then come back and say, oh, this program's ruined my drinking. Because, you know, you can only know what you know, and once you know something, you can't unknow it.
Mm.
As far as people who get sober without a program, well, I really can't comment on that. I know I tried for years on my own to do it, and I could go for long periods of time because I initially started as a binge drinker and turned into a daily drinker. I know that I could not do it without the help that I've received from around the world, and I have friends around the world, and I have friends around the world that I've yet to meet, because I can go to any country in the world and find friends, and these people, and the beauty of it is they know me. They know me like no one, they know me like no one else knows me, and I got my recovery from these people by listening to their story.
Mm.
Just a group of people sitting down telling their story, and I sat there, and it was it was a light bulb moment for me. And these were old men, you know, and it was like they were looking into my soul and reading my diary.
I get the impression as well that recovery is not just about stopping drinking, is it?
No, not at all.
No.
It's
What is it about?
Well, it's about, as I say, The disease of alcoholism really is, I have heard it referred to as a mental disorder. I'm not so certain about that, but I would definitely say it's a personality disorder, and that, you know, we are people who just are a little bit off the edge of where. I think also too it's about growing up is that when you start drinking, this is something I really need to tell you. When you start drinking, if you're 16 and you start drinking, and you start drinking really heavily, say, you know, completely wiping yourself out when you do drink, emotionally your growth has stopped.
Right.
So when you're 25 and you're still drinking, you're still 16.
Mm.
And when you're 40 and you're still drinking, emotionally you're still 16.
Mm.
So you don't deal with anything the way a mature person...
Dealing with emotions,
dealing
stress.
Dealing with life.
Dealing with conflict.
Just life on life's terms becomes a huge problem to you because you're still stuck in that 16, me, I want it all my way, and if things don't go my way, I you know, throw a wobbly. And that's... You know, that's the biggest thing, is that when you get sober, you have to grow up.
Mm.
Grow up, and it's a growing up emotionally, and for a lot of alcoholics, they have to learn to do simple things like just keeping their house in order and dressing themselves and being clean and whatever, you know.
Yeah. Now, I'm just going to mention before we finish as well, we haven't gone into this, and perhaps we can actually, you know, revisit this at another stage. But I have heard it said that alcoholism is a family disease because it affects everybody in the family.
It does.
And often, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but often the other members of the family start behaving in this very strange manner, almost a dysfunctional family, because of, you know, because it sort of sets everyone off.
Totally.
So that in itself is helpful to know that on the one hand, the responsibility lies on every individual for themselves, but on the other hand, that it may be that a family around the alcoholic is actually playing a part. And I know that Al-Anon is no longer on Waiheke Island, which I think is a real shame, because I think if you have a person, you know, a friend or a family member who is has got an alcohol problem, it's going to be affecting you. And to have that place to go to, because it can be a real place of despair for families, can't it?
Oh, look, totally. I mean, I'm the bad guy here. I'm the alcoholic. But I totally, totally feel for families of alcoholics, and particularly children. You grow up with an alcoholic parent, it's not long before you take the role of the parent, because, you know, there's that awful need to look after that person, and you worry about them, and they, you know, it's just it must be just horrendous for them. I didn't have that situation, but I can see it from their point of view, and just in my own behaviour, knowing what an incredible amount of stress, and it's everything. It's financial. They're drinking the family money.
It affects their whole life.
It affects everybody's lives around them, and particularly children growing up, whether they're young children or teenagers growing up with an alcoholic parent. Is just emotionally damaging for them, and they start playing a role that they have no business to be playing, but no choice.
Yeah. Look, I really hope that Waiheke does start another Al-Anon program on the island. I really hope that families or friends listening might even have that thought, that maybe that's something that they would like to do. But, Christine, I just want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story. So full of courage.
Oh, that's quite all right.
I totally admire you for the journey.
No, please don't.
No, please, let me say that, because at the end of the day, you know, in one way or another, we've all got something in our lives, whether it's alcohol or something else, that, you know, that perhaps we need to work on, or that we're trying to overcome in our lives. And I just have to say that the courage that it takes for you to accept the responsibility and to not put the blame anywhere else, but also to continue to work at it, surrounded by people that obviously care about you too and can share in that journey with you, but just the courage that it's taken, and the courage it's taken for you to come in today, I really thank you so much.
That's quite all right. And Christina, I got sober because someone else sat down and told their story to me, and I heard things and thought, oh dear, that sounds like me. And if there's just one person out there today who has heard something that's registered with them, that they think, I think I might have a problem and I want to do something about it, I would be very happy to steer them in the right direction.
Christine, how can people contact you?
Yes, my number is 9368. That's 3729-9368.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Christina.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
You're back on Iron and Life with Christina Patterson, and we're talking now to Emily Parsons, who's growing up on Waiheke Island. I mean, from little girl, or how long?
Yeah, since I was born.
Oh, nice. And so it must be nice to be back for a little while, is it? Because how long have you been over in East Africa for?
Oh, I go over every year.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay, so you go backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. So tell me about the Village Project and what you're doing. And that's Ghana, is it?
Uganda,
sorry.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so what are you doing over there?
At the moment, we're piloting a rain harvesting system for orphans and ex-child soldiers, part of an organisation that we partner with called Watoto.
Yeah.
So we're basically taking the skills of that my dad, Brett McDonald, has developed on Waiheke, of building concrete water tanks and teaching the local Ugandans how to build them, and replicating that over villages for orphans and ex-child soldiers.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me a bit about Uganda, the history of Uganda.
Well, it's got a bit of a rugged past. Yeah. So you've had Idi Amin as the ruler years and years and years ago, and that the nation was pretty devastated after that. But that was like, I think, 26 or 27 years ago. And then in northern Uganda, Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistant Army have been abducting and killing villagers for the last 27 years. It stopped about 6 years ago, but he's still in Congo and the DRC and southern Sudan. But so the northern part of Uganda has been, a civil war for 20 odd years before we started working up there. And so you've got, over 40,000 children who have been abducted as ex-child soldiers, and millions of people taken off their land, and women, mutilized their noses and lips, and kind of cut off. The soldiers would say, "Do you want long sleeves or short sleeves?" and cut their arms off, that kind of thing.
And that's still happening.
Not in Uganda. Uganda's really safe now, but it's still. But the Lord's Resistant Army and also Joseph Kony is still happening.
Right. So, when you were talking about children being abducted to join the army, what age are we talking about?
Anywhere from like 7 till 20 or older.
And so obviously with civil war and all this kind of stuff, it has a huge, I would imagine it has a devastating effect on the, just all aspects of the community, economy, poverty, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's huge. When I first went up to Gulu, which is the main town in northern Uganda, 7 years ago, it was just kind of finishing, and it was very devastating and very oppressed, and just a kind of horrible place, although it was beautiful at the same time. But now it's developing, and there's people have gone back to their land, started planting again, started doing things. So it's definitely on the up. It's not,
Yeah. So what, the work that you're doing is specifically looking at the moment at widows and orphans. Is that true?
Yeah. So we work with an organisation called Waitoto Child Care Ministries, and they have a model which they take either orphans and ex-child soldiers, and so that have no parents or no family, and then they take them in. And they build whole villages for them, and so in the village there's homes in clusters, and in each home there's 8 children with a mother who's either a widow or a divorcee herself, and so they recreate families, and that's their family for the rest of their lives.
Wow. So and we're talking about orphans because their parents have died from what, for what reason?
All sorts of things, and we've got...
Such as HIV?
Yeah, HIV. HIV is a big one. Childbirth, woman dying at childbirth is still a very big one.
Why is that? Why are women dying in childbirth?
If they live in the village, they have a complicated birth, complicated pregnancy.
There's just
they can't
not
get
the medical
to the
facilities. Sufficient medical facilities.
No, correct. Yeah.
Okay. And widows, same reason. I imagine HIV. But what are?
Yeah. Well, that was very. All sorts of reasons. HIV is a big rampant disease over there.
So they have. Do you know the numbers of widows and orphans in Uganda?
Oh, millions?
Wow. Okay.
In Uganda.
What's the population of Uganda?
Like 39 million.
Yeah.
It's the size of New Zealand.
Yeah.
It's the country. So
yeah.
There's a lot of people. Watoto looks after 3,000 orphans at the moment. And they also have a program for women with HIV as well. And that's over 5,000 at the moment, I think.
So you're obviously working to water is obviously a really basic need. So you're trying to help villagers with that, and you're trying to recreate families as well. Or
yeah, well, we partner with an organisation that does recreate families. So our unique thing is concrete water tanks and rain harvesting, and so that's a skill and a model that we've brought to the organisation, and they have seen it and gone, we really, really need this. This is an amazing solution to the problem that we have around water, because they do have boreholes and that kind of thing, but they run dry as well, and leaving, you know, a lot of people without water. So last year, and this time last year, we built 4 tanks for their baby's home, which was in northern Uganda, and they have anywhere up to 100 babies at a time, and they might not have water for a month or 2 months. And so we all know what it's like not to have water when you're looking after babies.
Absolutely.
So you've got a whole lot of sickness and things happening. So so our tanks provide a solution for water. Yeah.
So how did you get involved in this in the first place? What drew you to you know, Uganda of all places, you know, of all the places in the world, why Uganda, and why did you want to spend your life, I guess, helping people and doing that in this way, I suppose?
Yeah. Uganda, I've always been drawn to Africa as a continent, and have spent a bit of time in other countries. But why Uganda is really the organisation that we partner with. Watoto is phenomenal, and their model is, I believe, the best in the world for caring for orphans at that kind of scale.
Why do you think it's the best? What do they?
Well, because it's not an orphanage. So you've got a lot of orphanages in the world and in Uganda, where you'll have, you know, a big house, maybe 100 kids.
So it's an institution.
They're, you know,
it's not one-to-one love and family.
There's no connection.
Yeah.
And Watoto's ethos is to rescue children, raise leaders, and rebuild a nation through what they're doing. So they really aim to raise future leaders through their ministry. And the thing is, they're doing it. Like
I have lunch with the results. Yeah.
I have lunch with incredible young women and men who have studied to be lawyers, studied to be whatever, and they're amazing. Mm. And they've come from the gutter.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. And so, anything else that you kind of? Because I know that at the moment you're wanting to raise money for the Village Project. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, we're totally reliant on. We're a donor-based charity.
Yeah.
All our money goes to projects, so no one's paid for, you know, it's a fully volunteered organisation at this
point. So people are not paying salaries, in other words?
No.
If they donate, it's not going to salaries?
No, exactly. Yeah. It's going directly to the projects. We've got an event this Thursday at the Oyster Inn called Something in the Water.
Great.
Yeah, and that event is fundraising as the ticket. It's $100 a ticket, and it's a 4-course meal with Waiheke wines and beautiful of things. But we've got Bennett from Uganda, who's out at the moment. You might have seen in the Gulf News or Marketplace. So he's a Ugandan engineer that works for Watoto, and he's come out to he's been allocated as the project manager for our projects in Uganda, and so he's been learning firsthand from Brett McDonald and also from Becker Engineers.
Yeah.
And so with the aim that he can and his team can roll out these tanks without us there, and so they can replicate it. So he's here, and then also we've got Annie Duguid, who is Bennett's girlfriend. And she is the team leader of the baby's home. So she cares for she's set up and oversees the three baby's homes.
Yeah.
Which cares for, at the moment, over 250 babies at any one time.
And so now I did read that someone adopted, was that her that had adopted some orphans?
No? Yep, she's fostered and
adopted. Personally.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be really amazing, wouldn't it, to hear all about that. So tell us again, Thursday.
So it's Thursday the 1st of August. Yep. It's at 6:30 at the Oyster Inn. It's limited seats,
okay. Yeah. And so how do people get tickets?
So you can go online at thevillageproject.org.nz.
Yep.
Or you can give me a call on 027-664-1672 or email at emily@thevillageproject.org.nz.
Yep, and so what we'll do, actually, we'll put up on Facebook, I'll put it on the community, Waiheke Community Notice Board, and it'll probably go up on Waiheke Radio Facebook as well. All those contact details as to how people can get tickets, as well as Christine's phone number, who we talked to earlier. So we'll put that up. So before you go, I'll grab those from you. Thanks so much for the work that you're doing. It's fantastic.
Worries.
It's really good to know that some Waiheke locals are doing such amazing things out there. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's awesome.
You've been listening to the Interviews from Island Life, a weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.